KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood. Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lawrence Wright talks about L. Ron Hubbard, the Church of Scientology, and its special relationship with celebrities. His new book is Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. But first, the Hollywood News banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I am joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times, freshly back from Sundance. And John, tell us, I understand the business was very brisk at the festival this year.
Yeah, and it wasn't just for narrative films. There were a lot of deals done for documentaries. It was, to me, one of the busiest Sundances I have ever seen. I've been going probably 20-some-odd years. Some very big sales, like Fox Searchlight buying the Way, Way Back for $10 million, but a ton of deals in the $2 to $3 to $1 million range, and a lot of documentaries that have sold. So we'll see if it was the Mountain Air, if the buyers were, you know, maybe having a little bit too much at the local bars, but a ton of deals, and now it remains to be seen whether or not these movies will connect with audiences.
Yes, we saw last year, you know, Fox Searchlight, for example, which bought that movie The Way, Way Back. They bought Beasts of the Southern Wild, which turned out great for them. And then they bought The Sessions, which will probably be okay, but it didn't exactly set the world on fire. So who knows? But tell us a little bit about this movie, The Way, Way Back, with that big $10 million ticket.
Well, this is a comedy about a 14-year-old boy who goes on a family vacation. His mother is divorced, played by Toni Collette. She's with a car salesman as a potential new husband, played by Steve Carell. And the 14-year-old, as you might expect, is very miserable being around these two people. And he goes off and strikes up an unusual relationship with Sam Rockwell, who runs a local water park. It's an R-rated comedy about a 14-year-old, so you can kind of see the marketing issues. It played fantastically well at the festival, probably, to my mind, the best screening besides 20 Feet from Stardom, which was a documentary that the Weinstein Company snapped up.
That is a film about backup singers.
Yeah, this was a movie that not only screened incredibly well, but there was a concert with the backup singers as part of the Sundance Festival. The other thing that we should mention, we've talked about in the past, is some of these movies may never come to a theater, may get a token theatrical release. I think a number of these movies, and it's very hard to say which ones they will be right now, could be video-on-demand hits like Arbitrage was from last year's festival or Margin Call was from Sundance 2 years ago.
So, John, I know there are a lot of parties at Sundance. One of them certainly made a little bit of news this week. CAA, the big agency, had a bash and invited some, I guess, burlesque dancers who came, maybe delivered a little bit more than what was ordered.
Yeah, we've described it as kind of an NC-17 mashup of the orgy scene from Eyes Wide Shut and a bachelor party. We talked to a CA client who was there, a woman, who said she was deeply offended by what she saw. And the interesting thing for us and as industry observers is there are a lot of parties at Sundance and there's a lot of crazy stuff that happens there. But CAA, as you know, Kim, is an agency that fights tooth and nail to guard its reputation and is very careful about how the agency is portrayed. You know, there's a de facto dress code. They have the Death Star. They're imposing Century City offices. And for them to have this party where a lot of people were talking about it, not in a complimentary way. And to be kind of specific, there were characters with prosthetic penises. There were women dressed up pretending to snort cocaine off each other's arms. There were women on a bed simulating sex acts. I mean, it was a raunchy party. You just don't associate this kind of behavior in front of film buyers, executives, directors, writers, actors, with CAA. That, to me, is the anomaly.
And speaking of sex scenes, the Chinese apparently have taken issue with Cloud Atlas, the film directed and written by the Wachowski siblings and German director Tom Tykwer. They have excised nearly 40 minutes of Cloud Atlas for the audience in China. apparently, you know, issues that involve sexuality or political subversion, as they would call it, offend the Chinese censors, and they are gone. And, you know, this is a movie that cost a lot, only grossed $83 million worldwide. They really need that Chinese money, but I'm not sure what happens when you cut 40 minutes of a movie.
Well, yeah, you might make it into a running time that a lot of people can tolerate. I mean, Cloud Atlas was almost 3 hours long in the United States. I actually like the movie, but 40 minutes shorter is certainly a big whack to its running time. The other thing that we should talk about is, you know, there's some cuts to Skyfall as well, the James Bond film. And what this underscores is that when you're doing business with China, you're doing it under China's rules. And China, as we've talked about repeatedly, is soon going to become the world's biggest movie market. And yet censorship is still a huge problem there. And so if Skyfall or Cloud Atlas are going to show in China, they're going to show the version that the Chinese censors approve, not the films that the United States studios and directors have made.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn, the Los Angeles Times. And you can banter about Hollywood on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. Coming up, Lawrence Wright on his new book about Scientology. In 2011, author Lawrence Wright fascinated readers of The New Yorker with a substantial profile of filmmaker Paul Haggis. He won the Oscar for writing and directing Crash. Haggis had spent some 35 years as a Scientologist, but in Wright's article, he announced himself as one of the church's most high-profile critics. That transformation inspired Wright's new book, Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. We should say at the outset that the church has publicly denounced Lawrence Wright's book and sent a statement to KCRW to that effect. You can read the letter at kcrw.com/thebusiness. But Wright stands by his reporting, which was based in part on interviews with former Scientologists, some of whom were once high up in the hierarchy of the church. Scientology denounces such critics as apostates and liars. We began our conversation with Wright by talking about the charismatic founder of this religion, L. Ron Hubbard. As Wright's book explains, Hubbard's theology involves the notion that souls called Thetans were brought to Earth by the galactic warlord Xenu. Some of them are troubled and cause all the planet's ills. Wright depicts Hubbard as deeply troubled himself, so I asked how Hubbard inspired so many to follow him with such loyalty.
He was a prototypical charismatic leader of a new religion, and he was a spellbinding character. He had a special talent for bringing young people in particular under his spell. And, you know, he had a narrative of his own life, which to some extent may have been fabricated, about being a heroic figure in the war, how he had been blinded and crippled by his wounds and had healed himself at a point where real medicine had not been able to take care of him. And this was a very compelling narrative in post-war America. The therapeutic culture was just beginning to take root, and he wrote this book, Dianetics, in which he proposed that you can solve your own problems, your neuroses and fears yourself, just by reading this book. Boy, it swept the country. It dominated the New York Times bestseller list for a long time, and it really became the prototype for so many of the self-help books that followed. You know, when he wrote Dianetics, he wrote this book in a month and based it on studies that had never actually taken place. It was very ingenious in many ways, very patronizing in others. But I think he had a theory of human behavior, and it was expressed in Dianetics. And it rewarded him immensely. I mean, he became very wealthy, although he lost his money, and he lost control of Dianetics. And I think that creating the Church of Scientology after that was, you know, for the money, for the control, and also for the tax exemption. So those things made, you know, it a logical next step for him.
Yes, and he had been an extraordinarily prolific science fiction writer. And it felt to me, you know, that he at some point incorporated, I mean, because Scientology theory involves a galactic warlord, Xenu, and all of this saga feels a lot like science fiction, except, I don't know, maybe at some point he started to be confused himself, do you think, about what he actually made up and what he believed?
Kim, I think that he believed it. I know a lot of people think he's a fraud and a con man, but if that were the case, at some point he would have taken the money and run. Instead, he spent virtually all of his time, all of the days he had to live, exploring this inner landscape of his, writing about the cosmology that he was inventing and the bureaucracy he was creating to sustain it. So, you know, the level of commitment was really extraordinary. And also there's an interesting internal coherence to the whole body of thought. So it's like a breadcrumb trail into the mind of L. Ron Hubbard. Once you enter the Church of Scientology, with every step you take, you go further and further into his mentality.
Now, the basis of Scientology in some ways is the idea of going clear, ridding your spirit of burdens from past events, from this life or previous lives. Thetans, which are spirits that have been roaming the planet, implanting themselves in your body. And correct me if I'm misstating any of this, because...
No, you're doing pretty well so
thank
far,
you.
Kim.
And the way that you then become what is called an operating Thetan is through auditing. And auditing, well, why don't you describe that?
Auditing is a kind of therapy that Scientology practices. The difference between that and the usual experience of therapy is that between you and the therapist, who's called an auditor in Scientology, there is a machine called an e-meter. And if you're being audited, you hold these two metal cans. In the early days, they were Campbell's soup cans that had the labels stripped off. And they're connected with electrical wires to a meter, and a small current runs through it. And what it actually measures is your galvanic skin response. It's really one-third of a lie detector.
Right, it's like an element of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But according to Scientology, what it measures is your thinking. They think that thoughts have mass, and that actually the e-meter measures the movement of that mass. In any case, just imagine that if you are in a therapy session and you're on a lie detector, how that would change the equation. If you believe in the validity of this meter, the e-meter, then you can be led into some pretty novel and sometimes perhaps dangerous back alleys. For instance, many people in auditing remember past lives, past existences. And when they have these memories, they may not have very much substance at the beginning. But the e-meter tells them they're true. And the auditor asks them to put a little more, you know, imagination in it. You know, walk down that street, turn the corner, what do you see? Who's there? And eventually these confabulated memories acquire real substance, especially if you believe that the e-meter is telling you all along that this is real. And this comes as great news to people to think, I've lived before and I may live again.
So when you are audited, and this is kind of a key element to the celebrity element, I think, of Scientology, you are asked specifically pretty much to name any deed you've done, especially if it might be embarrassing or illegal, cause problems for you if it were known widely.
Absolutely. These confessions are essential to the auditing process. And according to some of the former members I've talked to, you know, many of these sessions are recorded, and they go on file. And if you turn against the church, they can be used against you.
So they've got quite a dossier on their members.
They do, on everybody.
So you talk about John Travolta. You come very close to outing John Travolta in the book, and you mention that David Miscavige, the head of the church, referred to him with a very unpalatable gay slur internally.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can explain what dead agenting is and how that might have been deployed against John Travolta.
Like every Scientologist, everything that John Travolta had to say in auditing was recorded in his file. And so who knows what he said or what damning or embarrassing things might be in there. But we do know that he told Bill Franks, who was one of the top executives in the church, my auditing files are confidential, right? At the same time that was happening, the church was worried that Travolta was going to put distance between himself and the church, and they assigned a member to go through his files and compile what's called a dead agent pack. In other words, black material that can be used against him if he ever were to step away from the church.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with author Lawrence Wright, whose new book is Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. In the book, Wright says that from the start, L. Ron Hubbard established the church in Los Angeles in hopes of attracting celebrities.
Hollywood was always something that he was interested in. He was an aspiring screenwriter himself.
And to the end of his life, thought he might be a filmmaker, right? I mean, late in his life.
He did. As a matter of fact, Hubbard hired Cecil B. DeMille's son, Richard, to be his assistant. And he constantly courted people that would be helpful to the church. They published a list of Scientology prospects such as Marlene Dietrich and Walt Disney and Jackie Gleason and Bob Hope and Howard Hughes, people like that.
Groucho Marx, I think, was on that list.
He wanted a star that could be Scientology's representative in the world, an exemplary figure. But, you know, that figure was so elusive. You know, Gloria Swanson came into the church for a while. Rock Hudson walked in for a bit, but he got angry at the auditor who wouldn't let him go put more coins in his parking meter, and so he stormed out. But there was always on the horizon the idea that one of these great stars would become a member of the Church of Scientology, and that would allow the church to take over the entire movie entertainment industry.
Now, and I think Hubbard actually had a very detailed plan and set of instructions how to bring in these stars, this idea of finding a fear that could be addressed.
Well, everyone who goes into Scientology is asked to name, you know, what is the thing that is your ruin, the thing that's spoiling your life, that stands in the way of your complete and utter happiness. And this is a very personal and powerful question. And for someone, for instance, like Paul Haggis, who was a writer-director that I profiled in The New Yorker and forms a big part of this book, his ruin, what was bothering his life, he had a troubled romantic relationship. And the church promised to help him with that. And he says it did. He went into the church with his girlfriend, and they took some courses on communication, and they worked on their relationship. It was like therapy, and it did help them.
There's a concept in Scientology of being a suppressive person or a potential trouble source. And right. One of the bases of Scientology is if you're doing it right, you should have no problems. You should not get cancer. You should not have issues in your marriage. If there is such a problem in your life, it is because you're doing it wrong.
That's right. And it may be because someone's standing in the path of your spiritual progress. For instance, if you go into the Church of Scientology and somebody close to you says, I don't think that's a good idea. I think that there's problems in that church. Say that's your mother. The church would say, well, you know, I think she's a suppressive person in your life. And you're going to have to make a decision because if you want to proceed along the course of our path to spiritual enlightenment, you cannot be associated with that suppressive person, your mother. And in this way, Scientology breaks people loose from people that are close to them. You know, oftentimes I've spoken to people that are, you know, have all of their family in Scientology. And when it comes to the point that they want to leave, it's wrenching because they know that those people that choose to remain inside Scientology will never speak to them again.
We reached out to the representatives for Travolta and another of Scientology's biggest stars, Tom Cruise. Each declined to comment. Coming up after a short break, how Scientology treats its celebrities and the very different treatment of those who dedicate their lives to serving the church. To comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lawrence Wright about his new book, Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. In his book, Lawrence Wright says David Miscavige, the head of Scientology, has a special knack for appealing to celebrities. According to Wright, Miscavige leads a lavish life. The opposite is true for members of the Sea Org, or Sea Organization, which functions as the church's clergy. So the Sea Org members, they are what they call on post, meaning on duty 24/7. They live in dorms, right, essentially.
Yeah, very Spartan quarters, oftentimes multiple families together. You know, the preponderance of them are in two places. One is in Clearwater, Florida, where the spiritual headquarters of the church is maintained. And the other is in a place called the Gold Base, or the Int Base, which is the international headquarters of the Sea Org. And it's in a desert compound.
Outside of Los Angeles, yeah.
Yes, about 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's very isolated. It's surrounded by a fence with spikes on it. It's got motion detectors, and there are guards. And the church officials say it's to keep people out, but it also serves the function of keeping people in. One of the people that was involved in the finances of the church told me that the average meal for a Sea Org member was a fraction of that of a prisoner in the California prison system. Whereas a truck each day from Santa Monica Seafood would arrive with lobster and fish from all over the world. New Zealand lamb would be flown in. The table for David Miscavige, every meal he had two meals to choose from. They were prepared for him.
So, which, of course, I'm sure begs the question, why would you be in the Sea Org?
Well, people join the Sea Org because they have a mission. And the mission is to clear the planet. That means to bring everyone to the awareness of Scientology's teachings and to eliminate the irrational fears and neuroses that drive mankind into plagues and wars and genocide and racism. This is the mission.
What about Tom Cruise? Do you think that he believes that he is saving the planet as well?
I think he believes it fervently. You know, the video that was posted a couple of years ago where he extols the virtues of Scientology, and it, to an outsider, he looks like a raving fanatic. But to someone who's inside Scientology, and especially inside the Sea Org, this is routine. This is the way that people feel about Scientology and the teachings of L. Ron Hubbard.
Of course, ironically, Cruise has also brought some of the most negative attention to Scientology. I mean, you can publish any number of things about Scientology, but when you bring up Tom Cruise, it becomes viral.
Yes, that's true. You know, but Tom's also suffered because of his relationship with the church. I think that he and other celebrity members of Scientology really suffer a kind of public relations martyrdom because of their religious beliefs. So you can say that Scientology is a network to stardom, as many people in Hollywood like to say. But the truth is, I think that it's really a very difficult cross to bear for so many of these people.
Now, one of the things that happens in Scientology, and especially for a celebrity, I guess, would be that negative information about Scientology is dismissed as false. And in fact, preferably, especially if you're in the Sea Org or you're Tom Cruise, you're not supposed to be even aware of and reading this stuff.
No, not at all. In fact, for a few years ago, Scientology was passing out sort of internet nannies so that Scientologists would have filters on their computers to keep out anything that was negative about Scientology. It's considered to be, within the term of the church, in theta, or an interbulating influence, something that's confusing and agitating, and there's no reason to look at it.
Now, this bubble, I think you feel that somehow a star like a Tom Cruise has some kind of an obligation, maybe, to inform himself, because, you know, maybe you can set the table a little bit on this, but there are some very dark deeds that have been done in the name of Scientology, people separated from their families, but also pretty much imprisoned.
Yeah, there are re-education camps that people are confined in. To me, a striking comparison. You know, the life of a celebrity inside the church and that of a Sea Org member can be told in the story of this young man that I interviewed who joined the Sea Org when he was 11 years old. Now, this is not unusual. Lots of children are recruited into the Sea Org, some much younger than that. This young man, Daniel Montalvo, joined at 11. He was at one point sent to Clearwater, and one of his jobs there was to help clean out the asbestos in the old Fort Harrison Hotel they had purchased there. And he says he wasn't given any protective equipment. Then, while he was in Clearwater, Tom Cruise came to receive some additional auditing, and Daniel was one of the little pages who guarded Tom while he was in auditing. And I just wonder what Mr. Cruise thought when he looked around and saw children attending him, wondering, you know, if he thought, where are their parents? Why aren't they in school? Later, Daniel went to California, and in Los Angeles, he was working two jobs for the church. And his nighttime job was at Bridge Publications, where they publish all these lavish books that they put out. And one of his jobs was to cut the thumb notches in the book, you know, the notches like you see in an unabridged dictionary. There was a machine that had a very sharp blade, whack, 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 like that, and he would operate it, and he cut off his finger.
At what age would this have been?
He was 16 years old. And he was taken to a hospital, and the escort from Scientology said that it was a skateboard accident. Now, I know that the church says that they obey all the child labor laws, but the labor laws in the state of California specifically state that kids are not supposed to be around heavy machinery, that not that age, and kids like that age are supposed to be in school. So I'm puzzled. I'm scratching my head about how that happens.
I think we should just mention that the church has denounced everything you've written as false, basically, in short form.
I'm sure they'll denounce everything I said on your program as
that
well.
That too. But nonetheless, obviously, you stand by your reporting.
Yes, indeed.
And did they cut you off at a certain point in terms of interviews?
Yeah, when I first started, I was granted access to people that were in the official church. So I interviewed, you know, Ann Archer and her husband and Mark Isham, who's an Emmy-winning composer, and several other people. But at some point when Tommy Davis, who was the chief spokesperson of the Church of Scientology, told me he wasn't going to talk to me, that access stopped entirely.
So you never got to interview David Miscavige, for example?
No, I never did. And, you know, he hasn't talked to the press for, you know, more than 20 years, so it's not a personal insult. But I think he's got a lot to answer for. You know, I had 12 people tell me that they had been physically beaten by David Miscavige. These are some of the top executives in the church. But, you know, if the church wants to deny, and they have denied that this happened, I think that Miscavige should come out and face his accusers.
Lawrence Wright is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and writer for The New Yorker magazine. His latest book is Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. And thank you so much for coming in today.
It's been a pleasure, Kim. Thank you.
We've come a long, long way together.
We reached out to the church for a response to Wright's book. Church attorneys sent a four-page letter that says, in part, Going Clear is, quote, riddled with mistakes, unfounded statements, and utterly false and unsupportable facts, close quote. To hear a longer version of this interview, see the Tom Cruise video, or make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna, Harriet Ells, and Melissa Morton. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.